Welcome to America's Fabric. I'm Charles Heller, and I'll be your host today. And I have the joy, pleasure, and honor of having with me Dr. David T. Hardy. Dave Hardy is an attorney here in Tucson, been in practice now 32 years?
35, I think. 37.
Wow. 37 years. Tempus fugit. My, how time does fly. And David has won in cases at the Supreme Court. He is probably the first time, I believe, he won in the Supreme Court was in the Prince and Mack versus United States. Is that correct?
Yes, I represent Sheriff Mack.
Right, yeah, and declaring much of the Brady Law unconstitutional. He was also in on the team with the Heller decision in 2008 and the McDonald decision in 2010.
Yeah, I filed a friend of the court briefs in both those.
Mm-hmm. And we're here today to talk about the history in part of what's called the Castle Doctrine, which we'll go into in a little bit more detail. But I would like to ask first, what is the tradition, what is the longstanding tradition of a person being able to defend yourself, in essence, stand his ground? And what is the tradition of being able to stand his ground?
Well, the idea that you can stand your ground, that is, there is no retreat requirement when you're subjected to criminal attack, really originates in American law fairly early. I know it was in place by the early 1800s. Before then, the English common law did have a retreat requirement. If you were under attack and you could safely retreat, and I emphasize safely, you had a duty to retreat rather than use deadly force. There's a study of homicides in 14th century and 15th century England where he actually goes into how it was applied, and the answer is the jury still found a person innocent anyway, so long as he hadn't, you know, killed a good citizen of the community. If he killed someone who really had killing coming, the jury found that he just couldn't retreat. And the man says, reading the jury records of the period, you would think that England was covered with cliffs, mountains, impenetrable hedges, and unfordable rivers, because no matter what it was, the jury will come back with, he couldn't retreat. He was cornered. So, in theory, they had a retreat requirement. In practice, they actually didn't.
So, even before there was a state of Tennessee, there was a tradition in England that there was some people what needs killing?
Yes, yes. I mean, we're talking now Robin Hood days.
Yeah. What was the study of the 14th century legal record?
It was interesting. He put down that you always have the temptation to believe the grass is greener on the other side. He had the idea while he was doing alternate service in order, because he was a conscientious objector and refused to go to Vietnam.
Hmm.
So he says, now I'm sitting here studying homicide.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
That author.
It came, the United States, like I say, went away from that. Oh, well, one thing I might mention is Don Cates has a theory as to why English law required retreat, which was that in English common law, you had virtually an unlimited right to kill anyone who was committing a felony. Technically, to kill in order to prevent the felony. And, of course, almost anything worth doing, including shoplifting, was a felony.
Hmm.
So, essentially, if the other person was doing anything wrong, committing any crime, you could use lethal force against them right off the top. So the only time you would have had a self-defense plea would be if it was two good citizens who weren't committing any crime that got into a fight. And so in that setting, it probably made sense to impose extra requirements on self-defense. Well, come over to America, and from the very beginning, we started trending away from the British trend and going to the idea that if you were in a place you had a right to be and a person uses deadly force or threatens to use deadly force against you, the blood is on his head, not yours.
Mm.
And it steadily expanded. I know here in Arizona, well, to back up, there's the debate about the wisdom of the various no-retreat laws. The truth is that in most American states, there never was a retreat requirement. I'm told by former Attorney General of Arizona that Arizona court cases rejected a retreat requirement as far back as the 1860s.
Hmm. In the territorial days, long before we were a state.
Yeah. Huh. A century before the legislature got around to passing the law. So most states were like that. And then the retreat statutes really are coming in just as a confirmation of that. And in a way, it's a confirmation. Just, you know, we don't want the courts tampering with it if they ever do change their minds. At last count, I think there were only about 6 or 8 American states that had a retreat requirement. And even those that did would require that you could retreat in perfect safety. So if you were actually under immediate attack, you had no retreat even in those states.
I know that I've heard a New York police officer, when I was at the SHOT Show last year, I heard the number five man in the New York Police Department tell me that if you were under a vicious attack, a life-threatening attack, and you had no way to immediately retreat, that you absolutely could use. In fact, he even told me there was no duty to retreat against an immediate deadly attack, that you could use deadly force if you were one of those rare people in New York who had the lawful authority to have a lethal weapon with you. Yep. That he said there wasn't a requirement if it was an immediate deadly threat, that it was only that if you could retreat that you must.
Yeah. You have to have the ability to retreat, and also it has to be in safety.
The bizarre thing about that is if we go away from the legal aspect of the use of force for a moment and we talk about the practical aspect of it, and I've been a concealed weapons instructor for a long, long time, 18 years, and the idea of attempting to retreat, if you look at the Tuller rule, which is the 21-foot standard, yep. Which is not written in law anywhere, but if someone has a drawn edged weapon or a blunt instrument, and they are 21 feet away with that instrument in their hand, they're a deadly threat to you because they can reach you in a second and a half. Mm-hmm. You cannot accelerate quickly. If they once they start towards you, you can't accelerate fast enough to get away from their reach, from them hitting you with whatever that is they have in your hand. You can only get off the axis of the attack and go left or right. You can't run away from them because they will catch you just by the principles of physics.
Sure.
So regardless of the legal aspect of it, it's just impractical as all get out to think that you're going to be able to retreat in many, if not most, cases. Certainly George Zimmerman couldn't retreat when Trayvon Martin was on top of him, pounding his head into the pavement.
Yeah, they cite that as an illustration of stand your ground, no retreat laws. It was never a factor in the case. I mean, when you're pinned to the ground, you cannot retreat, period.
Right. And that wasn't brought up by his defense. I don't know if you had a chance to talk with Mark O'Meara or not.
No.
I met him last year at Gun Rights Policy Conference. And he couldn't talk about the case at the time, but he talked all the way around it. And he talked a lot in GRPC about whether or not stand your ground was a great factor in a lot of cases. And he said in less than half the cases of self-defense, was it even a factor? I don't know the statistics of it myself. I haven't studied it, but I know that's what he told me. When did, if you know, in the United States, when did we begin in places, especially along the East Coast, like New York and Massachusetts, when did we begin to add in those things into our laws about a necessity to retreat?
I'm hard put to say exactly. I know there is one state, and not New York, it's in that area, though. It might be Connecticut, I'm not sure. There's one state that has a retreat requirement, and in it, it's the only state in the union that said you had to retreat inside your own house. And if you could escape in safety, you would have to escape out of your own house and let the aggressor have the house. That is the only state that went that far, and that was in, I believe, the 1970s. So I'm not dead sure of how long that's been in those states. Maybe they just never changed to a no retreat requirement. They may have started off that way and ended up that way.
It's in ARS, Arizona Revised Statutes, Title 13, ARS 13411. Okay. And 411 is the 10 crimes that may justify the use of deadly force. And it delineates in Part A what those 10 crimes are: murder, rape, robbery, burglary in the first and second degree, arson of an occupied dwelling, child molestation, sex with a minor. There's several others, aggravated assault in certain circumstances. And then the Part B says there's no duty to retreat before either threatening or using physical or deadly physical force.
As I say, Arizona has a no retreat required rule that goes back by court decision into the 1860s.
The next thing I'd like to cover, where did the original idea of of what we call castle doctrine, that a man's home is his castle, did that come from English common law?
Yes, that came from, the actual phrase, a man's home is his castle, is recorded as early as Edmund Burke's debates on whether Britain should withdraw from fighting the American Revolution.
Huh.
And so it comes in, and I believe it was recognized in English common law as an exception to the retreat requirement, that you could not, if you were attacked in your own home, you did not have to retreat, even if you could do so safely. So that dates all the way back.
It just seems to me immoral if a person is not doing anything wrong, and I realize morality is very divorced from law, and I realize sitting across the table from a preeminent lawyer, I shouldn't probably be bringing up morality in the room, but I know you to be a moral man. But the point is that it seems immoral that if a person has evil intent against you, and you're not doing anything wrong, that the idea that the law would force you to withdraw from evil rather than to resist evil directly seems not only immoral, but a misprision of government authority.
I would agree. And I was once at a lecture by, if I remember the name correctly, Professor Lerner, Renee Lerner of George Washington University. And she made a very interesting point, which was that there are few areas of law where the views of the average American diverge more sharply with the views of the legal elite, etc., than on self-defense. Because the legal standards for self-defense in most cases treat as equals the criminal aggressor and the victim. I mean, if you stop to think about it, as a victim, you can only use deadly force if you're faced with a deadly threat from the aggressor. Mm-hmm. So your lives are essentially treated as equals. You can only take his if it looks like he's going to take yours. Whereas to the average American, that's not the case at all. The criminal is substantially worse than the victim, and his life is worth proportionately less.
And, oh boy, try to sell that to Jesse Jackson and Al Sharpton.
Yeah. Ooh-wee. Well, I know of, we had a case here that illustrated where that guy had his young son was being molested by some guys who crept in the kid's room at night, and so he confronted them. And they threatened him with violence, essentially, that they would come back and take vengeance and all of that, and apparently broke into his house to make sure he got the message. And so he went over to their place and blew them both away. Mm. And the county attorney prosecuted him, which I think was criminal in itself. The first jury hung. The second jury hung. The third jury hung. And they took it to trial a fourth time, which is without precedent that I can remember, and finally they got a conviction on manslaughter. Mm-hmm. And afterward, some of the jurors said they wouldn't have convicted him. They thought he was eligible for probation, and they were upset that, in fact, he faces some mandatory jail time.
Why is it that courts will not allow juries to know what the penalty is? It seems to me that if the jury is the true triers of, are the true triers of the fact, that one of the facts would be how much punishment would a person get for doing it. Why is it that courts will not allow juries to know that?
It's part of a general process of surprise. Everybody likes power, right?
Yeah.
The courts establishing their power relative to that of the jury. There are several other aspects of it which, if you're practicing, you encounter. In some courts, you are forbidden to get close to the jury. You have to stand at a podium, except during closing argument when you're allowed to get down to about 5 feet. That manner of thing. Well, the idea was essentially that if the jury knew what the punishment was, they might be biased one way or the other by it. Generally, if they knew it was a horrific punishment, well, they might actually be tempted to acquit the guy. So that would be distracting them from their duties. I think it's all a bunch of something that would get us thrown off the air if I were to say it. Mm-hmm. If you look at the 18th century in America, the big thing in the jury argument was swaying the jury and pointing out the terrible consequences to the defendant and how he didn't deserve this sort of thing. I mean, that's Patrick Henry made a career out of that. And it made jury trials back then really exciting. And you had to be a good speaker. Today, they just get up as often as not and mumble about the evidence and the instructions. I think it'd make trials a heck of a lot more fun and be a lot fairer. And the jury would serve one of its historical purposes, which was if the legislature enacts punishments which the community thinks are unfair, the legislature has to face the fact that there's going to be a lot of acquittals. And this deters the legislature from going beyond what the community will really accept.
It's pretty much what happened with Prohibition. They couldn't get convictions against people who were transporting and making liquor, and eventually it led to the momentum that overturned the Constitutional Amendment. Yeah. Also, in Prohibition, they actually realized they didn't have the authority to do a law and had to change the Constitution to do it. Would that we would have such a government today that wouldn't just rule by fiat.
Yeah.
And besides, why are small Italian cars having something to do with our law?
I'd love to see jury nullification come in. Just remind the jury of its historical role and then have one hell of an argument over whether the punishment here is appropriate. Because legislatures are constantly adding on punishments so that they can go home and tell the voters they did something. And some in Arizona, you can't believe what they are, because if you add on different things, and they have things like the dangerousness allegation, you believe it or not, you can be convicted of homicide that wasn't dangerous. Because dangerousness only goes on if the prosecutor alleges it and proves it. Well, that kicks up the punishment by quite a bit. Now, you'd think homicide would be dangerous all the time, but no, the legislature had to find some way to deal with dangerous homicide.
Well, let's look at the obverse side of that coin. There's a case in Florida. I believe the lady's name is Marshall. I don't remember her first name. And she went to her ex-husband's home to pick up some of her clothing. And she didn't expect the ex-husband to be there. She had her children with her. And the ex-husband was there, and they, of course, got into an altercation. Mm-hmm. She felt threatened. She went back to her car, got her gun, and went back inside to get her clothing. Mm-hmm. The husband continued her threats. She took her gun, pointed it towards a wall away from them, 90 degrees away, and fired a shot to scare him, to intimidate him. It did accomplish the purpose, but he went and dialed 911 and reported it. Mm-hmm. She was arrested for aggravated assault, for endangering the children, and those two charges, because it was, as you say, it was listed as a dangerous offense in Florida. Florida has a thing called 10-20-30. If you use a deadly weapon in any assault, it's 10 years. If you fire the deadly weapon, it's 20 years. If you shoot somebody, it's 30. And if they die, it can be life, or in some cases, it can be the death penalty. Mm-hmm. And so it's a mandatory minimum. It's like you say, the legislators did something, were proving they could do something. And this lady has been sentenced, and the judge claims he has no jurisdiction to change the punishment. Mm-hmm. He sentenced her to 20 years this week.
Yeah. I've read some dispute over the facts of that case. There's some who say that she fired it, basically hit the wall pretty close to the husband's head. Mm. But everyone agrees, if you're talking 20 years for something where essentially nobody got hurt, maybe they were certainly scared, but nobody got hurt. I mean, 20 years is just too dang much. I think someone was pointing out that if she'd actually hit and killed him, it might have been classed as manslaughter, and she'd have gotten less time than she did for missing him.
Right. And she might, if she was truly in fear for her life, she might have actually been justified in shooting and killing him. And that's why it's so important that people understand that in almost all circumstances, it is not legal to fire a warning shot. In Arizona, if you do it in a city limit, you've got 133107, which is firing a gun within a city limits. You also have felony endangerment, which is 13-1201. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, if you didn't need, if it wasn't instantly necessary to fire that shot, you'll probably be charged with ag assault as well. And the mandatory minimum on that is 4.2 years in Florence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people need to understand you cannot do that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the paradox. You know, firing the warning shot is verboten.
Yeah.
Maybe they shouldn't. Maybe they ought to just put the first round where it would do the most good rather than let it wing off into the atmosphere.
Well, I tell my concealed weapons class participants that all warning shots should be to the center of mass. Mm-hmm. That's a sufficient warning.
Mm-hmm.
But I digress.
Good.
Would it be effective in Arizona? You talked about jury nullification. Would it be effective in Arizona to have a statute that forced the judge to tell the jury as part of the charging instructions that they had the authority, if they thought the law was wrong, to simply not convict people? If they thought that the prosecution was wrongful, even if the facts indicated he or she had done what they were accused of doing, that the jury has the authority to say not guilty, no matter what the prosecutor said. Would that be a beneficial thing in Arizona?
I think so. And it's hard to object to it because basically that would just be telling the jury the power that they really have and have always had. At least since the 17th century, I think it's the trial of William Penn. The jury has had the power to acquit against all the evidence for reasons it did not even explain. I think with Penn, he was saying, he called out to the jury, "Remember, you're Englishmen," and they called back something effective, "We will remember it." They found him not guilty when obviously he was guilty, and the judge started questioning, "How could you possibly do that?" And finally, the foreman just snapped something effective, that is our verdict, Your Honor, and you have to take it. And the judge backed down.
Well, if the government didn't need a jury, it wouldn't have one.
Sure.
And so it's obligated to accept the verdict of the jury. The thing is today, though, today I think if today's in today's courts, if the judge had said, why did you not convict him when the evidence clearly showed him to be guilty, and the juror said, because that's our decision, I think they might declare a mistrial. I think
once they acquit him, it's too late. When that verdict comes in of acquittal, that's the end of the case forever.
I suppose, yes, because it would attach double jeopardy if they tried to try him again.
Exactly.
The thing is, though, is if can the judge not, after the trial is over, declare it to be a mistrial, or does that violate the rules of procedure of the court?
If the defendant is acquitted, he can't. It's ended. As you say, if they ever brought charges again, it would be double jeopardy. If the defendant is found guilty, the judge can set aside the verdict, essentially, if he's got the appropriate legal grounds. Hmm. And it can be appealed on that. You know, one thing that I've thought we ought to do with our self-defense laws is make one change, which is right now the standard is reasonable fear of deadly harm. What about there really was basis to believe you were in danger? Not you had a reasonable basis to think you had to defend yourself, but you really did. Put them both in.
In other words, let's say you were in fear for your life, but you didn't know the assailant had a concealed weapon, and he did.
Yeah.
If you don't know that he had a concealed weapon, but you were afraid, it can't be introduced at trial that he had it because you didn't know it. What
exactly.
You're saying is, if he was armed with a deadly weapon, for instance, the Hal Fish case, and Knusley, I believe, is the name of the attacker in that case,
yeah,
the guy who died, the one who got shot by Fish, he had a sharpened screwdriver in his pocket, mm-hmm, but that was never introduced into evidence because Fish didn't know it at the time.
Yeah. And they couldn't get in that. The Fish charged that the guy charged at him, swinging his arms in a windmill-like fashion, which sounded pretty strange. The defense had evidence that he had attacked another guy doing exactly that. And they couldn't get in evidence because Fish didn't know, so it couldn't form the basis of a reasonable fear. As it turns out, after Fish was convicted, the court did reverse it because in the final argument, the prosecution ridiculed the claim that this guy would have run toward him windmilling his arms. And the court said, okay, it can come in for that purpose, not to prove the thing itself, but to rebut your claim that this is too ridiculous to be believed. Policemen face this sort of thing all the time. You wind up using deadly force against someone, killing them, and subsequently it's turned out that they are fleeing from a murder scene or wanted on a armed robbery warrant, but you didn't know that when you came up to them. So if you were to be prosecuted, that could not come into evidence. You didn't know it. It's not a reasonable belief. I say make it both ways. If it was necessary or if you reasonably believed it was necessary.
How hard would it be to draft a piece of legislation to get the idea that you were just talking about into state law?
I'd like to proofread the draft I have.
Careful about tipping our hand to the enemy there.
Yes, yes.
The last thing I'd like to know, is it your belief that the legislature here in Arizona actually understands the issues on the ground in the use of force and self-defense?
I don't think they fully do. I think they have a better grasp than most legislatures. I think some of their statutes need redrafting just because they haven't covered all the ground. They haven't thought through every possible alternative.
I'd like to thank you for joining us on this edition of America's Fabric with Attorney David T. Hardy. David, your website is?
HardyLaw.net.
HardyLaw.net. All right. Thanks for being with us today.
Sure.